From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Here's our lineup for today. Jury selection is underway for Harvey Weinstein's trial, and there's been plenty of drama. Then Fight Club novelist Chuck Palahniuk shares tips for a writing life in his new book, but that doesn't mean he wants to play it safe.
I want to tell the stories that at this point in history only books can tell. I want to tell the stories that are too dangerous to be made literal enough that they can be filmed.
And the comedy troupe Culture Clash finds current political parallels in a Baroque opera. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. Jury selection in Harvey Weinstein's criminal trial is underway in New York City. With opening statements scheduled for next week, the pressure is on to assemble a panel of 12 jurors and about half a dozen or so alternates. The process has been far from simple. The Wrap's media and politics reporter, J. Clara Chan, has been following the case from the courtroom in downtown Manhattan, and she joins us now from a courtroom hallway. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So a headline grabber from the case this week was that the supermodel Gigi Hadid was dismissed. Let's talk about the bigger issues. What do we know about the jury pool size and how the selection process is going?
Sure. So they've actually had sort of a two-stage jury selection process. So last week, that was essentially what we were calling a pre-screening. Prospective jurors were given a questionnaire to fill out, and then based on their responses on that, attorneys for either side could decide, you know, do we want to strike this person or not? And then starting today, which is a bit more exciting, about 140 prospective jurors came into the courtroom. And so there was a live sort of questioning period between the attorneys. And from that, right after this morning session that just wrapped up, it looks like five jurors have been selected already.
So one of the things that lawyers for Harvey Weinstein have been arguing is that people's history of sexual assault or knowing somebody who is a victim or a survivor of a sexual assault should disqualify them from serving on the jury. How has that issue been debated in the courtroom?
One of the sort of bigger misperceptions, even for a high-profile case like this, is even the idea of knowing about Weinstein or having heard of the accusations about him. That doesn't actually necessarily immediately disqualify someone. For the attorneys, it's more picking apart how does that information potentially impact, or would that information potentially impact them or give them a biases when considering the evidence that will be presented before them. And then obviously one extra layer for that is if a prospective juror has experienced sexual assault or knows someone who has experienced sexual assault, I mean, that is something that could very much influence how they view a case. And for the most part, what we've been seeing so far is for jurors who where that has been the case, they've sort of stood up and said, you know, I don't think I can be fair or impartial, and sort of already indicated that they shouldn't be selected. So that's sort of something we've been seeing there.
As potential jurors are being interviewed as part of this process, how much is coming out about how much they know about Harvey Weinstein and what he has been accused of?
I'm not sure it's a varying degree, but I think a large number of prospective jurors who have come in have indicated that, you know, they're familiar with either him as a person or have heard somewhat about his case. Obviously, there's like gradations in there. Some prospective jurors that say, you know, I actually read Ronan Farrow's book, so I feel like I'm a bit too familiar with this case, therefore I can't be impartial or fair. And other people might be saying, you know, I've heard about him, but I think I can sort of put that aside and just consider what's being presented as evidence, et cetera, as testimony, et cetera, if I were to be selected for the jury.
Ronan Farrow is the author of Catch and Kill, and he wrote about Harvey Weinstein in The New Yorker. It sounds like one juror already has been held in potential contempt of court over tweeting about the case. What has the judge said about the way that jurors and, I guess, lawyers should be behaving in terms of what they're saying outside of court?
Yes, that actually happened just this morning. They had called back in a prospective juror who had been sending some tweets that he shouldn't have been. and so he's going to have to come back in March after the trial should be all wrapped up to essentially make his case why he shouldn't be held in contempt. I mean, I think even on the first day, though, when it comes to public comments about the trial or how people should be talking about it, you know, the judge told the defense, you know, don't be disparaging towards the witnesses. Don't talk about them if you're giving interviews, to the jurors. You know, don't talk about this case. If you're still a prospective juror, don't talk about this case with family or friends. Don't text, don't tweet about it, etc. And then also for us journalists, we have to be very careful about, talking in hallways and things like that. We need to make sure that we do not in any way interact with jurors in a way that could influence them or anything like that.
We're talking with J. Clara Chan from The Wrap about jury selection in the Harvey Weinstein trial in New York. She's joining us from a New York City courtroom hallway. Weinstein's defense team has requested a change in venue, which I believe the judge has denied. What is their argument in terms of why the jury pool in Manhattan may not be impartial to Harvey Weinstein?
I think it goes back to, again, the idea of, this is a very high-profile case. And given that Weinstein, was a prominent person in New York, their concerns are that, it's almost impossible to avoid news of Weinstein here in Manhattan. And then also in recent motions, they've requested a venue change multiple times. But more recent motions, they've also pointed to a couple of protests that have happened on some of the days of the trial as more examples of, clearly this is something that, people are talking about. It's unavoidable, et cetera, things like that. But, the judge has denied their requests. And his reasoning has sort of been, because this is a national or even international story, there is no place you could go where people would not be likely to have heard of him.
Sometimes in questions lawyers ask potential jurors, sometimes in motions they file with a court, you get a glimpse of potential prosecution and defense strategies. Has any of that come out so far through jury selection about how this case might be tried?
So the trial really hinges on the accounts of two women who have come forward to accuse Weinstein. Obviously, the defense will be very focused on rigorous cross-examination to poke holes in these women's stories or to somehow demonstrate to jurors that the relationships were consensual or that the alleged victims, maintain relationships with Weinstein. And the prosecution, on the other hand, will be demonstrating a pattern of behavior that Weinstein may or may not have engaged in, and really focusing on using the two women's testimonies along with witnesses to bolster their case, essentially.
We're talking to you on Thursday. Monday is a holiday. Hundreds of potential jurors are being interviewed. Is it really likely there will be a jury impaneled by the end of next week and that we actually might hear opening statements by next Friday?
Actually, I do think so. I think we are actually on schedule, and the defense attorney, we talked to them, I want to say yesterday or day before, and they were also pretty confident that we would be following schedule. I mean, with this morning session that just wrapped up, already five jurors have been selected, so there's still a couple more days to do this, and I do think by next Wednesday we'll be hearing opening statements.
J. Clara Chan is a media and politics reporter for The Wrap. She's covering the Harvey Weinstein trial in New York, and she joined us from a hallway outside the courtroom. Clara, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thank you.
Coming up next on The Frame, Fight Club author Chuck Palahniuk tells us the first rule about writing books. Chuck Palahniuk's first novel was already a success when it was made into a 1999 movie with Brad Pitt.
The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club.
And now Palahniuk's latest book offers a new set of rules, so to speak, but for writing. It's called Consider This, Moments in My Writing Life After Which Everything Was Different. But for a writer whose work has often pushed the limits of what's acceptable, especially when it comes to sex, violence, and graphic imagery, how does Palahniuk expect a person to write something new and original while following a set of rules?
You know, there's a difference between writing what you're born to write and how you write what you were born to write. And the mistake that I see with so many beginning writers is that they take a story that is so close to them. It is the story of their abuse. It's the story of why they no longer fit in the world, this enormous, enormous source of personal pain. And then they tell it using very conventional, very mundane writing methods, and they completely dishonor the story and they take a very powerful story and in effect reduce it to a kind of comedy. They make it really banal and laughable, which is their last intention.
I'm going to ask you to read a section from your book. It starts at this highlight and goes on to the next page.
My guess is that people haven't a clue how to get along. They need a structure, rules, and roles to play. Once those are established, people can gather and compare their lives. They can learn from each other. Tom Spanbauer always said, "Writers write because they weren't invited to a party," unquote. So bear in mind that the reader is also alone. The reader is more likely to feel socially awkward and crave a story that offers a way to be in the company of others.
That is so much about how the audience receives a story and how the writer has to, in some ways, kind of figure out what they are going to be receptive to. And it feels like that is alchemy, that there's no way to really teach that. You have to understand it. As you're trying to write about how to write, is it hard to put in words that special relationship between author and receiver?
I don't even ever consider that relationship. You know, the only time I consider it is in workshop when I am testing the premise for an odd way, an odd form of voice in a story. And I'll bring in a sample or I'll bring in a situation and I'll read it in workshop and really listen to people's visceral reaction, whether they laugh or groan or whether there's a sharp intake of breath, because that's the best feedback you can get. And also you can listen for the kind of silence that shows they're not paying attention anymore.
Does it ever surprise you the way that stories are received? Because there's so many different ways that people interpret Fight Club, for example.
Hey, I always fall back on Roland Barthes, the death of the author. It's not my job. I just make the Rorschach thing. I don't tell you what it means.
We're talking with writer Chuck Palahniuk. Several of your books and short stories have been adapted into film, not just Fight Club, but Choke, the short film Romance. When you're working on an adaptation of a book or a story, what does that teach you about storytelling going forward? Or are they totally separate experiences that are things unto themselves?
You know, I have never written the adaptations. The only thing I've done is written the sequels to Fight Club in graphic novel form. And that was a fantastic learning process, telling the stories and depicting motion in a sequence of still images was great, was a huge challenge. I want to tell the stories that at this point in history, only books can tell. You know, I want to tell the stories that are too dangerous to be made literal enough that they can be filmed, that stories that can't be shown on an airplane, that can't be shown on television, even on any of the streaming services. Otherwise, I should be screenwriting.
What is it about that you just don't want to be homogenized? You think that those stories aren't the stories that you were born to tell?
My best teacher, Tom Spanbauer, my first day in his class, I wrote a really nice story. I mean, Cheever would be really proud of this story. It was such a nice story. And Tom said, in the Taoist world of 10,000 things, what does this story have to offer that is worth people's time and attention and will make it stand out in this world that is already so crowded with things? And I got it, that I want to write things that stand out in the world of 10,000 things.
I want to ask you about some of the authors that you cite in your book, because something occurred to me, and I'll read the names, and you might see it yourself. Bret Easton Ellis, F. Scott Fitzgerald, John Steinbeck, John Berendt, Armistead Maupin, Amy Hempel, Cormac McCarthy, Tim O'Brien, Stephen King. Bunch of white guys, mostly 20th, 21st century authors. Is that your area?
I never stop blowing the trumpet for Naomi Moon. Have you read Naomi Moon, Miles from Nowhere?
Mm-hmm.
Every time somebody comes up and says, I'm a high school teacher, what should my kids read? I say, they should be reading Junot Diaz and Naomi Moon and maybe Sherman Alexie. Okay?
All very good authors. Yep.
Naomi Moon is glorious. And she is the Asian American Dennis Johnson. And so they should also be reading Dennis Johnson. But you know, white people have been in the pipeline longer, so there's more to recommend.
But how do you change a model where it's not only different voices that are heard, but different stories that are heard? How do you start getting the conventions of publishing and book buying changed so that people are more receptive to hearing different voices?
Well, there was a fantastic book a couple of years ago called The Program Era by a man named Mark McGurl. And it was all about the history of the MFA writing programs in the United States in the 20th century. And one of the ideas that he supports throughout the book is that fiction had to be standardized in order to be graded with standard grades. And so that all of American literary fiction eventually had to fit into one of three slots. One was technomodernism, which would be like Gaddis or Pynchon or David Foster Wallace. Another one was cultural pluralism, high cultural pluralism, which would be anything from a kind of outsider marginalized voice. It would be Naomi Moon. It would mean the house on Mango Street. And then the third one was dirty realism, which is sometimes called Kmart realism, which would be Raymond Carver, Joyce Carol Oates. It's kind of really low, gritty white people. One definition was that they are poor people who aspire to whiteness. But I think that once we recognize those three classifications, we can start to write outside of them. And it won't matter who the voice is, because it will be less important that it fit into one of those three very narrow categories.
You write in the book, too, about how many books and stories there are about communities of women and girls, but not so many about men. Are you consciously or even subconsciously trying to fill a void in that regard?
I think I'm just sort of playing the game. You know, when we were little, we would make up games at the drop of a hat. We would throw planks out and say, okay, this is lava and this is safe and you have to go from here to here and you can't touch this and you can only be here for 3 seconds. We will just arbitrarily, you know, create the condition of our lives. And I love that. And the idea is always, you know, citing sociologist Victor Turner, to create these little experiments, limnoid experiments, that we hope are so entertaining and serve people so well that people will adopt them and make them institutions like Burning Man.
What do you enjoy about writing?
The greatest part is when I surprise myself. And sometimes that's not until the book is out, and then I'll be on the road and I'll realize what I actually was writing about. And I will be mortified that I made something so deeply personal known to God knows how many people. And the idea that Tom always taught, again, Tom Spanbauer, my best teacher, his method of teaching was called dangerous writing. And the idea is to write about some aspect of your psyche that you cannot resolve and you cannot be with. You have to find a way to so completely explore it and exaggerate it that you exhaust all of your emotional reaction to it. And typically, by the time you've written the book, that thing disappears entirely because you are no longer emotionally, psychologically reactive to it.
When you are best known for a certain book, for Fight Club, is that a blessing or a curse? Is it hard to get people to think about you as an author of anything other than that?
How many Shirley Jackson novels can you name?
Probably not many.
You can name two. And you can name one short story. And I tell my students, if you can have one novel that people know and one short story that people know, then you're in the pantheon.
Chuck Palahniuk is a writer of many books. His latest one is Consider This, Moments in My Writing Life, After Which Everything Was Different. It's out now. Chuck, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much yourself.
Up next on The Frame, the comedy group Culture Clash is breaking down boundaries again, this time with a classic opera. How is this for an artistic recipe, several Marvel superheroes, live Baroque music, and three Chicano comics? Yes, the experimental Long Beach Opera is at it again. The company invited the satirical comedy group Culture Clash to create a non-traditional take on an operatic classic. It's King Arthur by the British composer Henry Purcell, and the hybrid production finds parallels in today's immigration realities on the border. The Frame contributor Marcos Najera has this report about the company's latest world premiere.
More than 300 years ago, the Baroque British composer Henry Purcell made a name for himself writing music for the church, the court, and in a modest way, even the theater. And in 1689, he premiered his first opera, Dido and Aeneas, the love story between the Trojan hero and his queen. You're listening to a classic recording of the work by the late great American singer Jessie Norman. She's singing Dido's Lament. And then Purcell wrote King Arthur, his first work that fused opera and theater in a hybrid genre that's come to be known as semi-opera. It joined his music with text by the poet John Dryden.
I am Arthur King, and I want to thank the Migration Policy Institute for the opportunity to join you today.
Oh my gosh, yes, you know what? This is King Arthur Redux.
Rick Salinas and his colleagues in Culture Clash were commissioned to adapt Purcell's classic for Long Beach Opera.
I will be providing an update on our negotiations with the Mexican government about the payment for the border wall.
In the original story, King Arthur has to defend his kingdom. Ultimately, he faces tough choices about who does and doesn't belong inside his castle walls.
I would consider it a border story. It's like so in our DNA right now as playwrights, as social workers, in a sense, in the world of art. It's set in January 2020. And so everything that you will see in this opera are things that are happening to us right now as a nation, except instead of Britain, we're putting it in the United States. And we have set it in the Camelot O'Neill Behavioral Mental Unit.
I'm ready to defend the diocese and the preeminent kingdom.
Basically, it's a person who has a phobia because of all that this person is listening to in the radio, and his illness has only been happening in the last 3 years. But he starts realizing that these enemies are not people that are trying to invade, trying to take something away. He looks really deeply and he sees that there's children that are in cages and then there's parents that are being separated. These are the enemies that have been fed to him. And this happened to King Arthur too. He thought that the Saxons were going to come in and they were going to ravage England. And so that's what he fought against. But when you look real closely, those people are not the enemy. They're not the aliens. They're not the what the superheroes need to fight against. Instead,
yes, the superheroes. I forgot to mention that part.
Wonder Woman.
It turns out that this new production casts the characters as well-known superheroes.
The way I'm looking at it is the Wonder Woman in all of us.
Soprano Jamie Chamberlain sports a red cape and high-heeled boots on stage. But instead of a golden tiara, she wears a nurse's cap because she works in a hospital. And her patient is Arthur King.
Nurse Guinevere brings her femininity, which is one of her superpowers, and brings her lightheartedness, joyfulness, healing nature, and sort of power to control the atmosphere around her. She brings that all into our Camelot mental health unit.
These are times where people look for heroes on all sides.
That is Long Beach Opera artistic director Andreas Mitasek.
Because, you know, it's not just black or white.
Mitasek says we are living in tricky times, so it's hard to know what or who to believe these days.
We have a misguided hero, right, who is just, you know, sometimes people just hear constantly a lie and start believing it.
And if you look closely at the actor playing Arthur King, there's a slight resemblance to Donald Trump. But Rick Salinas says this production team made an artistic choice to keep the president out of this story.
It cheapens the art. The jokes aren't any better. What it is the fear of the other. And that fear is what this administration is feeding people. We have to put that in opera form.
Gotta sing about it. Sing through it. If we can't get ourselves out of it, we'll sing through it.
Sing through it. Figaro, Figaro, Figaro.
I'm Marcos Najera for The Frame.
King Arthur is at the Long Beach Opera this Saturday and Sunday. And that'll do it for today. Remember, there's another way to keep up with us, and that's by signing up for our weekly digital missive. You can find it at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.